But you can't always be trying to force things on other firefighters. That's not really what you want to be doing. Get yourself squared away, and then they will come to you, sort of. You know what I mean? Firefighters are attracted to firefighters who have their shit together.
Firehouse Vigilance presents The Weekly Scrap, a podcast dedicated to the never-ending fight against complacency.
Corley Moore, Firehouse Vigilance, Weekly Scrap, number 120, bringing in the new year in style because the first guest of 2022 is none other than Ray McCormick. If you were into the job at all, then Ray needs no introduction. He just recently retired after a 38-year career with the FDNY. I could start listing everything that this man has done, but it would take too long. So here are just some highlights. He was the chair and lead author to the FDNY Engine Company Operations Manual, developed and taught basics to standpipes for all FDNY firefighters, founded Urban Firefighter Magazine. He's on the FDIC Advisory Board. He sits on UL and NIST studies. He teaches and speaks across the country. He instructs. He is passionate about engine, ladder operations, leadership, and improving extinguishment culture. I'm a little excited for this conversation. My brother, Ray McCormick, welcome to Scrap episode number 120.
Well, thank you, Corley. It's my pleasure to be here. As you know, we spoke for quite a while and finally pulled the trigger on this show, and I'm happy to be here to lead off 2022 and episode 120. It's my pleasure to be here.
I'm really, really excited. So we'll get right into it. Is there anything I missed in the intro that you want to add that I left out?
Oh, I don't know. There's a few things maybe, but it's pretty good capsule of a very lucky and great career, to be honest with you.
Awesome. All right. Let me see where we're at here. Getting my buttons mixed up. There we are. All right. We got a ton of people logging in. They say, good evening, gentlemen, from Robert Queen. Happy New Year's, guys. Fantastic way to start off the year, from Joe Gavita. Let's go. A living legend, from Christopher Snow. The legend himself. That's Kyle Romagus chiming in. I'm just kind of catching you up on everybody saying hello here. There is too many.
Nice.
Mo Davis says, best of the best right here. The Book of Roy, let's go. That's from Greg Johnson. Okay. Yeah, there's a ton that are welcoming and very excited. Yep. Almost as excited as I am.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's great.
All right.
It's wonderful.
So, get your questions ready, audience. If you have questions for Ray, get him ready. Fire him at him. I will dig them out and throw them at him. He will answer them if he so chooses. But right now, I'm going to start off right out the gate and say, I wanted to ask you about your father, basically your dad. How much of an influence did he have on you, and what was your story into getting into the FDNY?
Well, my father, like hopefully most fathers, have had a tremendous influence on my life. Unfortunately, I lost him at an early age. I was 25 when I lost my dad. And however, he did see my entry into the FDNY, and that, of course, made him very proud because he was a former member of the FDNY as well. He worked part of his career, which is very ironic, in Ladder 120. So it's kind of funny. We have episode 120 here. And then he finished up in Ladder 143, which is in Richmond Hill, Queens, and which wasn't actually too far from where we lived, where I lived as a kid in Cypress Hills, Brooklyn. And I can remember the firefighters coming to the house every once in a while on the truck. They might have a run in the area, stop by, come upstairs, you know, wearing the boots and the coat and, you know, just these huge men. And, you know, quite the positive influence on a young boy, and going to the firehouse. Not a lot. I don't think I went there a lot, but I did go to the firehouse on occasion. And years later, I was doing the forcible entry truck. We had a truck that would go around and do a forcible entry drill throughout the FDNY. And I was part of that. And we actually went to that firehouse, and, you know, I was looking around, and it was quite intriguing to be there all these years later from when I was a child. And another interesting thing that happened there by chance was the first cover we did for Urban Firefighter Magazine was a picture of an engine company from FDNY that had a 2.5, and none of the firefighters are facing the camera. They're all facing towards the hose line. And we used that as our lead cover for the magazine, the inaugural issue. And it was 294 engine, the engine in that firehouse, because I saw an actual photo in a frame of that. We had gotten it from the photographer, and I finally put two and two together. And I mean, just like you talk about
full circle
coming together, right?
Yeah.
So it was very interesting. And that cover, all our covers meant so much to us. This, you know, fire magazines can be judged by a lot of things. The cover is the first thing you see. You got a good cover, it tells a story all on its own. And, you know, I'll talk about Urban Firefighter too as we get into it, but certainly my dad had a major influence on me. However, I also did the thing that I think a lot of young men and women probably do too, is I didn't want to just follow in my dad's footsteps. I wanted to go somewhere else. I was interested in radio broadcasting
and
television production. And I went to college and I finished that. And I worked at CBS Television in Manhattan for a little bit. And that job was going nowhere fast. So it turned out that my dad had pushed me to take the fire exam. And it was the only one I took. I didn't take the police or anything else. It was the only one I was at least partially interested in doing, because I had some knowledge of what they did and the friendships that my father had with other firefighters and how, what a wonderful world that was. And so it turns out I put up the resistance for as long as I could, about a year and a half. And then I went on to fire department. Of course, there was no turning back from that. So, you know, he guided me a bit, guided my hand in those early years. And, you know, then you want to live up to whatever that reputation is, whether it's just in your head or whatever. And, you know, nobody's perfect. I mean, I had my slip ups, too. But overall, you want to lead a career that you can be proud of. And I've been fortunate enough to have some wonderful, wonderful mentors throughout my career. And my dad was my first one.
Beautiful, man. And yeah, and I asked that right out the gate, kind of selfishly. My son just got on the job, and so I always, like, whenever I find out someone is a legacy firefighter, I always like to get their insight into it from their perspective. You know what I'm saying? And so I love hearing that, man.
I've been fortunate. I was a boss for about 25 years, lieutenant, and I was fortunate enough to work with some sons of firemen that I had worked with previously.
Oh, wow.
And that seeing their sons and their sons getting into the company where they were, or the firehouse where they were, and then entrusting their kids basically into your hands is something that, I mean, that's a big deal.
Dude, that's
a big deal. I always took that very seriously. People I looked up to, worked with, went to fires with, and now I have their most precious person in their world working with me. That's a big deal.
Dude, that's a huge, huge mantle of responsibility.
Yeah.
Which is one thing I wanted to talk to you about was, you know, were you always as plugged in and engaged as into the job and just fired up? Is it just some way you were wired, or was that a big part of it, or
Nope. There's a story there too.
Oh, yeah.
No, I was working. I was assigned to Ladder 24 when I got on the FDNY. It's with Engine 1. It's right by Madison Square Garden and Penn Station. Tremendous place to work. Just phenomenal place to work. I was so glad I got there. I worked in the truck. And, you know, the people that worked there, we had probably the best. We had division in the firehouse, Division 3. And they handled all the fires in Midtown. So you had basically, well, Vinnie Dunn was one of the chiefs. Everybody knows who he is.
Sure.
Vincent Dunn. We had some other chiefs there. We had many chiefs there as well over the years. These were senior chiefs for the most part and men who had a tremendous amount of experience. And just to listen to them and, you know, what went on in that firehouse, it was the hub of basically the firefighting world for high rise. And, you know, it was just an amazing place that, you know, I just just last night, there was a post on Facebook about Father Chris, who is a chaplain at St. Francis of Assisi Church, which is across the street from Engine 1 and Ladder 24. And the chaplains that I knew, three of them, Father Julian Deacon, Father Michael Judge, and Father Chris, all came out of there.
Oh, wow.
And they were Catholic chaplains for the FDNY, and they kept their car there. The FDNY gives them a car to use. And, you know, the firehouse takes care of their car, anything else they might need. And these men are just phenomenal people to know. Wonderful conversationalists, great friends. You know, I still have a recording of Father Michael Judge wishing me a happy birthday.
Wow.
I mean, you know, so there's so much more to firehouses than just taking in runs. The people are what you remember the most. The people that you worked with and had the opportunity to engage with. And some of them are fleeting. Some are more involved than others. I mean, you know, as a young firefighter, I would see the rescue come there every once in a while. I'd go upstairs and talk to the chief. The boss had to talk to the chief. And the firefighters and the rescue would all be standing there. And these firefighters are called from out throughout the city. And they're responding to every working fire in the borough of Manhattan. I mean, you talk about experience. And then watching how they operate and how they hold themselves and how they are. What is their personality? And for the most part, they were all gentlemen. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't have egos.
Sure.
There's plenty of ego. You have to have a decent ego because, you know, you have to care about what's going on and you have to care about yourself and you have to be confident in what you do. And that's part of your ego. But of course, you can't let it go overboard. But my point is, these guys were such a tremendous inspiration to me, and as were the people I worked with. Don't get me wrong. The people I worked with were phenomenal firefighters. But, you know, I had a chief say to me once, he said, you know, the rescue, he says, I'm going to ask them to do something that's a lot more dangerous than I'm going to ask anybody else to do. And there were times when they had to do things like that. And it just, that's the fire service. I mean, you know, there are phenomenal firefighters everywhere. Don't get me wrong. They're phenomenal. And I had some wonderful, you know, senior firefighters, you know, I'd like to talk about seniority, but let me just get into your original question, which was I always into it? No, I wasn't. I was just a regular come to work, do everything. I don't think I was super into it. Then one day, one of the firefighters I worked with came back from another ladder company and said, oh, Ray, you should see their compartments, how organized they are. And I looked at ours. We had a long we had a Seagrave rear mount, and we had a transverse compartment behind the crew cab. And it was probably about 2 feet tall and about a foot wide. And it was just filled with tools just laying on top of each other. So if you wanted something, three came out instead of one. And those two landed on your feet. So wow. I was like, said to the captain, I says, hey, would you mind if I built a shelf in here and tried to organize this a little bit better? And he was like, go ahead. And that kind of started me. I can remember back, that was the key thing that got me started. I ended up doing all the compartments. People have to realize the rigs back then didn't really have much in them. There was not all these fancy shelves that we have today and everything segregated and things that held specific tools. There was none of that really. And so these were just blank canvases for the most part. So I redid the saw compartment. We had an electrical compartment. I redid all the things in there. And it was just something I got into doing a little bit of, you know, it was all scrap plywood and 2x4s. It was not expensive or anything, but it made me happy. And I knew then that you could do more than just show up to work.
Nice.
I mean, I wasn't a bad firefighter before that. I don't
sure,
know.
Sure. I get and your I, point completely.
But the other thing is you have to be careful of. I think some fellas get a little confused with, and they get a little over the top. You don't need to be over the top. You know, start small. Keep it to yourself if you want. Do a lot of self-improvement things. But you can't always be trying to force things on other firefighters. That's not really what you want to be doing. Get yourself squared away, and then they will come to you, sort of. You know what I mean?
Oh,
firefighters are attracted to firefighters who have their shit together. And I just, you know, you don't have to force anything down anybody's throat. Just let it be organic. You know, I think that's the reboot for 2022. The fire service needs to reboot. You know, if you're going to a conference, that's wonderful. That's a place to learn. It's not a jumping off point to come back and think everybody you work with is terrible firefighter. That's not what conferences are about. Look, I watch social media heavily. I've been involved in it since it started. It's a great tool, no doubt about it. But I think some people have gotten a little bit off on tangents where, in reality, just work on yourself. Let it be organic. Get good. People are attracted to that. Don't be in people's faces about things that maybe they're not into. Look, we all don't like the same foods. We all don't like the same drinks. Variety. It's okay. You know, I was never into this is going to sound kind of funny. I was never into ropes, yet I was involved in probably the biggest rope rescue there ever was.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that I want to do technical rescue. I don't. So I think you have to find your way. You have to find your way in the fire service. And that starts off in your own firehouse. Be good in your own firehouse. Mm. Be true to yourself. To me, it just came to me. And I think that's the better way. Let me just talk about teaching. So teaching. All right. So people say, oh, well, you've been teaching. Yeah. I didn't teach till I had about 20 years on a job. I went to FDIC. And I was involved in the live burn hands-on class. And I went there, and I was already a lieutenant in an engine company. And I was told, you're going to do the safety line. Okay, that's what I did. I did the safety line. I was low man on a totem pole. I wasn't going to get to do what I normally did at work. But you know what? This was an opportunity for me to learn. And I learned, and I worked with a phenomenal group. And this group was, I mean, they never had an injury. Now, that doesn't mean people couldn't get hurt.
Sure.
But we did it the right way. The people who laid out the program, and one of them is Mike Lombardo, one of the things he laid out in that program is stuff that they've involved in 1403 today. We were doing it way before it was in the book. And there are some things that have happened prior from when we taught till now. If people had taken this class, those things wouldn't happen. And just some very basic safety things. So we had the modern fire. We had black fire. We burned mattresses and couches in rooms. The room would go to flashover, and we would bring the attack crew in. Now, remember, these students, we've never met them before. We have no idea what they're going to do. They could, you know, freak out. They could do fantastic. They could just do middle of the road. So the people that bring them in, those bosses that bring them in, those people have to be more than just a certificate holder. They have to be the people that will put this thing out if something goes sideways.
Wow.
And that to me is a true mark of a good boss. You know, we can't just plug people in everywhere. You have to be road tested a little bit. And that class led me down the FDIC track. And like I said, so eventually, I don't know when exactly, maybe a year or two later, whatever it was, I ended up actually doing some engine classes, like lecture classes. And then I went on from there. But it wasn't like in my wheelhouse originally. And I had written articles for probably 10 years prior to that. But I often say to people, I said, you know, what's this FDIC thing? I don't even know what it is. Like, I'm one of their authors, and they don't send me an invitation to go there. How do you get involved in this? And I got involved through Timmy Collette, and that's how I got there.
Wow. And I'm just writing down. I'm taking notes as I go. I want you to understand. I have to, A, mark moments when there's a great soundbite that I want to keep. And then, B, every time you mention a name that was an influence with you, like so far I've got Vincent Dunn, Mike Lombardo, Timmy Collette. That's a pretty impressive people that have influenced you. I have a question coming at you from the audience. Are you ready for your first one?
Sure.
All right. I'm going to tell – let me go back up here so I can read it here. Garrett Crotty asked about the FDNY Engine Company manual, and we're going to get to that in a bit. So I'm going to pass his question up for now. I just tell you we'll come back to that because we are going to talk about it. But Travis Caton wants to know, because you did this, you transferred from a truck to an engine, what is your top piece of advice to a newly promoted officer on an engine company who spent the majority of their career on a truck?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was me. That was me. Exactly. Your greatest resource will probably be the firefighters in that company. I was fortunate. I went to 69 engine. Obviously, what I believe to be the best engine in the city. Captain Patty Brown was the captain. He personally asked me if I wanted to come there. Obviously, we had had some interaction prior with the rope rescue, and I knew him because he worked in Rescue 1 as a firefighter, and that's where I first met him. And so I would say start with them. They are your best resource, and they are going to work with you. If you develop a good relationship with them, they will work with you to solve issues that come up. And again, a soft hand is a little bit better to use than a hard slap. Hold your drills. Definitely do your drills. Now, there'll be drills that you're going to learn from, because there's definitely things you need to learn. Take care of those people. You know, I say people before paper. In my leadership class, I say people before paper. And this is exactly one of the things where people before paper comes in. Take care of the firefighters you work with. Always be their best advocate. You are their best advocate. If they're mad at somebody, whatever, you have to have the cooler head and present the case the correct way. If they've gotten in trouble, you have to be the buffer between someone who wants to get at them and them. And you have to be in the middle of everything for them, for them. And whether they've had a bad day, we have to shake that off. We have to try and shake that off. Now, some things, obviously, if someone's having an issue that is affecting their fire world, then we have to find out what that is, obviously. Sure. But obviously, people can have a bad day. They come to work. Something's not happening right in their life. Hopefully, they can shake that off. But the other thing is, pay attention to them and be all in. If you want to drill, drill. If they want to drill at night, drill at night. Always say yes to things that are positive. And always teach them that when you want a line, you get a line. You got to get into the game. I mean, I have some ways to do that. I talk about in my class about how to get into the game. In other words, you go to a large fire, how to get yourself a piece of that action. Because, you know, even if it's overhaul, there's still plenty to learn in the overhaul of an apartment with a hose line, plenty to learn. So take your opportunities, drill for a specific amount of time, do it when it's best to do it. In other words, when people are tired, they don't want to do that. And if you miss a day, it's okay. It's okay to miss a day. I think this whole thing of like, oh, we have to drill every day. Yeah, every day is a potential day to drill, but it may not be the day you want to do it. There are just things that come up, whether you've been running around all night. And you know what? You know what? We need to take a little break for our people. We have to worry about our people more than anything. You can hold drills in debilitating heat. Maybe some people can. From New York, we learned that into that. You know, we were sensitive to the weather conditions, and we were sensitive to how much someone could perform. You can't drain a firefighter out of their energy and then expect them to perform 100% at a fire in a half hour from now. So I'm saying drill, get the method across, get the idea across, but don't beat your people up in the process.
Beautiful. There you go. Hey, already, man, we are 23 minutes in, and there's so much knowledge, so many nuggets already dropped. And this is the next one. I have other questions come at you. But Kyle Romer, Smoothbore Cartel himself, said, Ray gave one, if not the best, keynote at FDIC. So this is a perfect segue into the next point. It's 50-50. Either you're going to do it or you won't, man. So talk to me about, and talk to the audience about that speech, man, A Culture of Extinguishment. Fear does not save lives. Go.
Yeah, the FDIC speech was in 2009. And obviously it turned out to be a lot more than I thought it was at the time, and has since been watched by quite a few firefighters. And I've been fortunate enough to learn that lots of departments show it to their young firefighters, which is a very it's a great thing. I'm proud of that. That's great. I believe in it. There's nothing in that speech that's terrible at all. A lot of people. And I called for a culture of extinguishment instead of a culture of safety. And that's where people got a little crazy on the speech, I think. And what we have done since then is we have moved towards that culture of extinguishment somewhat, I believe. But the speech was very interesting in the fact that it touched on a lot of topics. I talked about where I worked. I talked about the people I worked with in the past, people who had mentored me. And I basically wanted to tell the fire service that they're doing a great job. We do have to value, you know, our stretches, how quick we turn out. We do have to value all those things. We can't have people saying those ideals are not valuable anymore, because once you have that change in culture that way, we have a problem. You know, it's just like if you're going to go sick, let's say you don't feel well, you really don't want to do it on a holiday on Christmas morning where somebody else is going to get stuck working. You know, you're going to have to just, you know, deal with it unless it's some crazy thing that you can't. But you have to have that inner pride where, you know, the company you work in is the best. And once you believe that and you work towards that, that helps you solidify a lot of things, especially as a boss. You have to have the faith in your people. But the FDIC speech. So I do the speech. And then I'm starting to hear things about, hey, I heard you said something about safety. And I was like, yeah, you know, whatever. And, you know, then it became an even bigger deal. It was really quite the big deal on the internet for probably about a solid 3 weeks. And a lot of people took their opportunity to take a shot at me, whether in blogs were very popular back then, or just, you know, in random chats or whatever it might be. But the intent of the speech was never to upset people, but it was to try and reset the fire service. And again, like I said, we've gone through since then, that's 12 years ago, we've passed a lot of things. We've done a lot of things. We've had UL studies on hose streams. We've had, you know, differences in nozzle sizes and, you know, tip sizes and flows and pressures. I mean, the fire service has really embraced the culture of extinguishment, whether they want to believe it or not. In fact, in the Pass It On series of books that were done.
Yes, the Gold Fender.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So I was lucky enough to be in all three of them.
Nice.
So the first one I did was the culture of extinguishment, because a good friend of mine, Jason Bresler, said to me one time, he holds a leadership conference as well, Leadership Under Fire. And we went to the first one he had in Philadelphia. And that's when we were doing Urban Firefighter magazine. He was writing for us, and he's a wonderful fella. And he said something about the culture of extinguishment. I wrote him a letter. I said, Jason, you have a misunderstanding of this culture of extinguishment. This is not a bad thing. This is a good thing. And so that's basically... I basically rewrote what I had written Jason, and he got it. But what was happening was there were a lot of people that were upset by the speech, and they wanted to take possession of it. In fact, there was a fellow who was going to teach at a conference he was going to do a class based on my speech. And I called the conference people. I said, are you kidding me? Like, this guy's going to bash me for an hour and a half, and you're going to let this happen? And anyway, the program was pulled. And I said, if it isn't going to be pulled, it's not a problem. I'll be there, though. You know, I'll be in the first row.
Right.
So, look, you have to defend yourself a little bit. You know, like I said, you defend your reputation, build a good reputation, but you have to defend it as well. So, anyway, there are a lot of things that went on there. John Norman and I were both interviewed by Bobby Halton after the speech. And John's wife thought the speech was fantastic. She said, you know, I laughed, I cried. It was great. And I thought so, too. And I still think so. So
there you go.
It is what it is. And I hope in my head, I know it happened. We pushed people towards extinguishment culture and how important that is. I just recently wrote a blog about how the fire service has to be careful about, you know, when you're, and I know, look, I know people go on a lot of EMS calls. When I was in the engine, we did about 1,400 a year. Now, FDNY, when I first came on, we never did any of them. We didn't do it. We didn't do that at all. And now that same area, one engine, has done 3,000 in any given year. They do about 3,000 medical calls. So a neighborhood went from zero to 3,000. Now, of course, there's more people living there, but it's not about the density. It's about how people are. It's a cultural thing. So I know people go on EMS runs, but we can't have an EMS-based fire service.
Preach.
Because the first rule of all the EMS classes I ever went to was, is the scene safe?
BSI, scene safe.
Yep. And every fire scene, I'll ask that question, is the scene safe? Hell no. Hell no. But we're going to do our best.
Right on.
So right there, in that first declarative sentence, is the difference. And they do wonderful work. You know, God bless the EMTs and paramedics. They're wonderful. But we have to be thinking about extinguishment. Even if you don't do it a lot, it has to be first on your list. When it starts to slip, we're losing something here. And the same thing with in the speech. I basically said, you know, if we stop thinking about the public and we put ourselves ahead of them, how can I ask somebody to go over the roof of a building on a rope to get somebody if I've always, you know, told them, don't worry about it. You know, the civilian, they're not that important. You know, they are important. They're extremely important. That's what we come to work to do, to protect them and protect ourselves as well. But the protection for ourselves really comes with standard operating procedures. And I know, man, I used to get a lot of pushback on this, but I think it's changed a bit now. Places would be like, hey, you know, that's standard operating procedures. We can't really have that here. And I'm like, why not? You know, pretty much every area that people live in, there's some sort of standardization of homes. You know, whether it be bi-levels, colonials, there's a way we can come up with some slight SOPs so that we're not making it up on the fly every time we turn out. That's just not.
I do love that.
When you have a game plan, it gives accountability because now we know where everybody is. FDNY, you can work in any borough in the five boroughs and be first due, and everybody who's first due, second due, third due, whatever, knows exactly where they should be.
Nice.
Citywide, depending on the building or whatever it is. They know. And that streamlines operations. And once your operations are fairly streamlined, things go into operation very quickly.
Beautiful, man. You have to have a playbook. You can't call audibles unless you have a playbook, right?
Yeah, but people would fight that. They would say, oh, no. But I think, again, with this emphasis on a culture of extinguishment, I think we've moved in the right direction. Like I said, to me, the UL studies that I was involved in, which, as Dennis said, the names are ridiculously long, but I'll just call it, the first one was the interior and exterior stream study. And again, I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah, that's a long title, man. That thing is
so. You can find it. You can go on their website. You'll find it, obviously. You'll find the study. And it came up, and I basically said, you know, I want to be involved in this. And they put me on there. And then I was one of four that was grandfathered into the coordinated fire attack, as, you know, Dennis was one of them as well. But the first study, and studies are what you make of them. Anything is what you make of it. You're on a committee for whatever it is. We did a lot of field testing of equipment in my firehouse. And I always wanted to give it the best shot, because when they look at you as a company that will look at a product honestly and give a good evaluation and are into it, that's good for the company's reputation. And it also puts you on the cutting edge of what's going on in your fire department, that, hey, we got this new tool. You know, this is a place we want to send it to. These guys will work with it, and they'll put it through its paces, and they'll give us an honest feedback on it. So again, you know, with that, you know, if you have the right kind of firehouse, there are hospitals and there are teaching hospitals. Well, right. There's firehouses and there's teaching firehouses.
Nice.
You know, where the brothers teach each other. You know, like I said in my speech, the place I got to was they taught themselves. They would drill on their own. They didn't need me to be there saying, do this, do that. They had the basics. They worked on things that they thought were important for their to get better at what they do. And, you know, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. You know, so Did I answer that question or
not? There's so much in there. Let me catch you up on something. Some of the reactions that you got. There are currently over. Yeah, there's. I can't even count the comments. But 100%, he said, Michael Allen said, say that louder. In reference to when you're referencing an EMS-based fire service, say that louder. Is the scene safe, said Marco Rodriguez with an exclamation point. Walter Lewis said, doing too much takes away from proficiency. Amen. Louder for those in the back, Ray, came from Kevin McCart. There's some fist bumps. Todd Edwards gave you 4 fist bumps. Boom from Smoothbore Cartel. So a ton of big reactions, man. Yeah, people love it. Good stuff. All right.
Well, I mean, you know, the shame is, I understand that, you know, the majority of the fire service is understaffed and they have a majority of runs that are not fire related. I get that. I came from that world. Like I just said, we were doing about 1,400 runs a year on medical. And, yeah, that's over 100 a month. That might be more than some people go on for everything. I don't know. But we had that task. We dealt with it. But, again, you're going to see that change. You're going to see that change. Telemedicine, there's going to be some changes made to that. Probably because of what we've been going through for the last 18, 20 months, whatever it is. So you're going to see some changes in that. And I hope so, because it always astonished me that they could give somebody CPR lessons over the phone, but they couldn't ask them a couple more questions as to their actual status for other EMS calls. And you get there basically and the bag was packed. And I was right. Like, couldn't you have asked this person what's really going on? Or, you know, this, I don't want to get into it because, you know, it's everybody who does this stuff knows the issues. But don't lose sight of those fire trucks that you walk in the door and pass every day, because they are the lifeblood of the community. Look, we can teach CPR to people, no problem, but we can't teach firefighting to people. That is done by firefighters. And that is your value. And you have value. You have value, and you can't forget that. And unfortunately, we see a lot of people who go to the upper ranks in fire departments who really are only interested in their own self-improvement. I mean, look, some of these guys have a Scrabble game behind their names, you know, with all the degrees they've gotten, and they're wonderful people.
Right.
But, you know, some people are degree hungry, and they want to jump to the next rank. And I've seen that in the FDNY, where we had people jump from rank to rank, and you're like, did they not enjoy being a company officer? I enjoyed being a company officer. That's all that was great. Once I got there, I was like, this is the place to be, because you're the closest thing to the firefighters, and you're the buffer between them and the higher-ups. And you have to satisfy the higher-ups. You do have to satisfy your bosses, or else – nothing's going to work. So you have to satisfy them, and then, you know, you work with your people. And you have to do things for your people that maybe they think aren't so great. But when they know that you're looking out for their best interest, then they're okay with it. They're okay with it. And, you know, like one of my buddies always said, make sure you pay them. And that is so true. You could be terrible on reports. You could write the worst reports. They can be late. But you have to make sure, if you're responsible to pay your people, you have to make sure that their money is lined up, their overtime is in, their differentials, whatever it is. That you have to do. Now, you deal with them people before paper, but that paper is more important than any report.
Love that.
I mean, I could let a little story out of school here. I suppose I am retired, but kind of... one of the prevailing things was, at one time, we would get a notice to do something, and I would say where I worked, not just where I worked, but in the larger place where I worked, that first notification would be read, crumbled up, and thrown in the garbage. And then the second time we got it, it'd be read a little closer, but it'd still be thrown in the trash. And then the third time, it'd be read and, you know, acted upon it. Best we could, but it took three times at least before
that's a different rule of threes.
Anything came down and was passed back back up the chain. It was just like, nah, not the first time, sorry. And then, and they knew that. They knew that. It was just the way of doing business, so to speak.
All right. Sorry, get me a... Next one I had planned for you was, what do you feel is helping the fire service and what do you feel is hurting the fire service? Which we've kind of already been touching on it, because yeah. I think that like a massive turning point was that speech. You know what I'm saying? That's been helping the fire service, but go ahead. What, in your estimation, as you go around and teach and speak, what do you think is helping? What do you think is hurting?
Well, I do think, because I'm in that world, I think, conferences have helped, firefighters, no doubt about it. Now you have to have an open mind when you go to something like that. Whereas, if your note taking is good, you can kind of differentiate between, hey, this fellow's got this staffing, I have this staffing. What about what they're saying? Can I incorporate?
Sure.
Now, one of the things that I loved about our standpipe operation was the fact that my buddy Jim Smith and I worked on for years. We developed the FDMY standpipe stretch. There was no stretch. There was the packs. There was the pack layout, but that was all there was. And in 69 engine, when I was there, we developed some how to flake out the hose, how to use the midpoint, all that stuff. And I did that with the firefighters. We did that down in the basement. We worked on it. And I wrote an article for our internal magazine, WNYF, with New York firefighters. And I'm not going to remember exactly when that piece was, but it's by at least 15 years ago. Nothing was acted upon. It stayed in the magazine. It never made it to the book. So eventually, when the book comes around and we're doing back to basics and we're teaching it, we're basically being able to show the firefighters how to do this. Two firefighters can easily stretch the three lengths of hose. It's not oppressive. It's not an oppressive task. It's 150 feet of hose. So that stretch, if none other from New York, that one specifically can be used pretty much anywhere. And even with low staff.
Right, yes.
So that was a good bridge, because sometimes people are lost in the fact that we have a lot of firefighters. And I always said, listen, we have a lot of firefighters. I get that. But there's only two firefighters on the nozzle team. There's a nozzle and a backup. And I wish everybody had that. I do. And, you know, we're blessed with the staffing we have. But we also, the FDMY also integrated a policy that they changed years ago, was that the second engine would help the first engine. Because it used to be that each engine kind of did their own thing. And they might get help from the second engine, but basically the second engine would stretch their own line. Now, they wanted to get away from that. They felt that there were issues with that. Now, I can't tell you whether there were more injuries or anything like that. I don't know the background of that. I just know that for years now, the pairing of engines has been something we do, which has worked out very well. But it can also have this an underbelly of we need help. So an engine that can do something by themselves or is really good at it is wonderful. Now, you have to remember, too, a good portion of the city is private dwellings, actually. The FDNY has a tremendous amount of private homes in the different boroughs and the different response areas. When you do vertical firefighting, when you go up staircases before you actually lay your hose out in a hallway or a stairway, that's a little different. And that's where the help is necessary. It's necessary in other places too, but
sure.
When the problem is really seen when you get into these bigger buildings and these taller buildings and stuff like that. So we instituted that, and I think a lot of places should do that. I mean, I've been to places where the second engine believes their first due when they're following the first due engine. The first due engine stretches a line. The second due engine stretches a line. They still believe they should be first due. they're asking for water at the door. They're asking for water at the door. I mean, that to me is a recipe for disaster. And yeah, you get away with it for so long, but eventually one day it's not going to work out too good. And then your department is going to be looked at with a big magnifying glass. And that's not where you want to find yourself. There's no reason to find yourself in that spot these days. The proliferation of knowledge that you can get at a conference. We'll go back to the conference thing again. My biggest issue with conferences is don't preach to me, teach. This whole, you know, we're not, you know, people getting up and preaching certain things. No, 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 no. Don't preach to me. Teach to me. Tell me what's up. Don't tell me, you know, all this, you know, feeling stuff necessarily. Give me the nuts and bolts of what makes me a better firefighter. Can I implement it where I work? How would I do such a thing? So many years ago, I did an FDIC class called Hose Loads and Deployments. And I really think it would be a very popular class even today. So I had about eight guys from, and Kurt, you mentioned Kurt. Kurt was one of them. Had Kurt come up and help me with the class. And he did the triple layer load, which is something they use at his fire department. And he went over it, and he had some good methods for using it and how to repack it. And I basically had all these different hose loads. Like, we had the Detroit bundle. We had the Kentland bumper load. And we had people who knew these hose loads and how to deploy them. So basically, you went from one to the next, because no matter where you work, you're basically going to get the hose loads that are on the back of your rig, and you're not really going to get exposure to much else.
Right.
And that exposure hopefully comes from a conference. So there are some great conferences out there that can do that. And, you know, it's just – obviously, conferences are popular because fire departments aren't holding up their end of the bargain.
Right.
I mean, if you were getting everything you needed at home,
right,
you wouldn't have to go there. I mean, it's fun to go there. I'm going to go to Kurt's thing next month in January, where he's going to have five well-known speakers, authors, and they're each going to teach for a day, and I'm going to take that in, and it should be very interesting. So, obviously, you know, there's a lot to learn from people like that. And there's a lot of young people who are coming up with some interesting things as well. I'll tell you one thing I don't believe, and I hate this line,
okay,
is that there's nothing new invented in the fire service. I think that is absolutely ridiculous, and it's incorrect. There's plenty of new stuff in the fire service, and don't think you can't come up with anything new, because that's just putting yourself behind the eight ball a little bit. There's plenty of stuff that hasn't been talked about and hasn't been thought about. I just recently was at a Christmas party for the firehouse, and it's mostly attended to by former members. The current firefighters come, but it's basically former members that show up. Anyway, I'm at the table, and I'm sitting with a former fireman that worked in the house. He's now he's a captain. And we were talking about some hose line positioning things that he said, you know, these aren't in the book. And I said, you're right, they're not in the book. So I've been working on them at home, trying to figure out, you know, presenting the case, sort of like doing a white paper on it, if you will, about, right, you know, what he brought up to me and what I think, and, you know, both sides of the coin, which you try and look at if you can. And that's the best way to do it. And that's great. I mean, when he mentioned that to me, I was like, wow, this is fascinating. I love this idea. I'm going to go back home and work on it. And to me, that discovery, that love of trying to figure something out, is what separates a presenter from someone in the fire service who is a thinker.
Nice.
You know, there's regurgitation, and there's inspiration. You know, there are a lot of your best people are probably not only mentally inspiring, but they're coming up with things that other people haven't necessarily thought about. And I think that's the key to good conferences.
Beautiful, man. So much to unpack there. Brother, you're killing it. I'm going to catch you up with a few comments. Jeffrey Bryant Jr. just said, Ray is one of the kindest, humble, and knowledgeable badasses I've had the privilege to meet and learn from. Thank you, LT. And so that's a huge compliment, and coming from a badass himself. All right. Now I'm going to catch you. I had a question about ultra high pressure. I don't know. Let me find it here. And it is, have you done any research? This is from Seth Thompson. He wants to know, have you done any research with ultra high pressure stuff, and does it have a future in the fire service at all?
The FDNY has a special high rise committee. I might be calling it the wrong name. It might be ultra high rises, or where they're looking at that type of thing. We have a special hose that they use to hook up, high pressure hose. Certain companies have it. The Midtown engines have it. It's red. The use of that to what they were really looking at was what would happen if the standpipe went out of service, basically. You know, what would we have to do in that case? So there's another interesting thing. So back in 2009, after my FDIC speech, I spent 6 weeks at headquarters on a vacation. So while I was there, I presented a chief with a paper that I had written, basically what we called at that time evolution. So I made up this evolution where we would put the hose out the window or, you know, over a ledge, whatever it might be. In other words, the standpipe packs would be connected and then they would be dropped down to the ground level as opposed to a rope stretch bringing them up. So he says to me, oh, did you come up with this because of the Deutsche Bank building fire where we lost two firefighters? I said, no, chief. I said, we had done this on drills prior and we had it tested in two different boroughs, Manhattan and the Bronx, and we got water in the line very quickly. And, you know, I had some, you know, how you do it, the equipment, all that stuff. That got into the book finally when we did the engine book in 2020.
So 13 or 11 years later.
You know, things take time. Again, what I really wanted was the fact that we would give the parameters of how to do it. But really what I wanted, the ultimate goal was to get this in the book so that when a chief officer is confronted with a, let's say, an out-of-service standpipe, they have a reference in their head because they've studied these books and these operations. They have a reference in their head that when a boss says, hey, let's do an exterior standpipe stretch, they'll say, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, I'm familiar with that. I read that. It's in our book. Yeah, I read that. There was nothing in our book. There was a call for it, but I think the frame of reference was missing. So anyway, at HROC, we've been doing this for probably 10 years at HROC. Mm-hmm. We do it every time. We do standpipe stretch, and it's for anybody that wants to use it. You know, it works. It works. So, you know, people say there's nothing new under the sun. I don't buy that at all. I don't buy that at all. Granted, we've done hoisting stretches, but reverse it down, that's a whole nother ballgame. And people always say, well, how many pieces can you do? I think you should only do what's within that company's capability. In other words, if an engine brings up 150, but you only need 200, all right, so we add another piece, that's fine. Get somebody else, get that second engine's hose and use that. But it should be within the capability of that engine. So if it's three lengths, it's basically 15 floors. If you had to go 30, you're going to need two engines to do the same exact thing and tie them together, whatever it is. You'll figure it out. But the point was that it was going to be down and dirty and be able to be done by like the first two engines.
Right.
Not that we would need a multiple alarm assignment to accomplish this. So, you know, it's all doable, but we have to think about these things and we have to be willing to try them. The first time I tried it, I didn't ask for permission to do this. I had the hose hanging outside of an apartment house 3 feet away from somebody's window with a coupling. And, you know, if that broke the window, all right, I'd be on the hook for that. But basically, you know, I'd rather beg for forgiveness than ask for permission because some person sees that, some chief sees that and says, oh, there's no way we're doing that. Well, right. We did it, took pictures of it, and, you know, worked out very well. So now it's part of the book. So it's great.
And that goes right to what you said. The next one is why firefighters need patience. You brought it up, and I think that's a beautiful reason. Go ahead.
Well, you know, the patience thing, look, people say, oh, you know, the fire department hates the change. That may be. There are things we don't want to change, obviously. But you also have to remember that we can't be zigging and zagging all the time. Somebody comes up with a one-off, and now we're going to change everything. We can't do that either. You know, we'll never be on a steady course otherwise. So if the ship takes a little while to change course, that's okay, because then we have the ability to look at both sides. And I'll bring you to this. This is a perfect bridge into the interior and exterior stream study. So Governor's Island study done in New York they looked at exterior streams and their effect on the fire. That was basically it. They had these buildings on Governor's Island, and they put them on fire. I did not get asked to help on that project. Whatever. A buddy of mine also didn't get help. We had a lot of live fire experience, but anyway, they do that. Okay. So it comes out, and basically it showed that FDNY could put a stream in a window and we darken down the fire. Now, FDNY does not do exterior streams to a big extent. Most of our streams are interior streams. So that is a thing for us, right? That was a bit of a watershed, if you will. Now, what that also did was, it was sort of like the domino effect. If FDNY does it, we can do it. So at the time, transitional fire attack was very popular. And it had basically had the full reign of the fire service for probably 5 or 6 years. Totally, people were writing articles about it. And, you know, they would claim, oh, look what the study said. But we had no interior study. We had no interior fire attack study. So even if you wanted to protest a piece in a magazine, you'd say, well, all right, where's your study? Well, we don't have one. So it's almost opinion now. So then the interior and exterior fire study came about. And I will say this, Steve Kerber, another name, phenomenal person in the fire service. A lot of interesting stuff has come out of UL under his reign. And so we had our first meeting, and I asked for a long hallway, that the project have a long hallway. Now, this was a change from what they had normally been doing with their homes that they built. Now, they built two 1,600 square foot one story structures at their lab in Illinois, Northbrook, Illinois. And both houses were exactly the same, furnishing the whole bit. So he gave me the long hallway, 24 feet long, 8 feet tall, and 3 feet wide. Now, the 3 foot wide came about because I asked them about it. They had had another hallway in a smaller house, and it was a shorter distance hallway, and that was only 3 feet. And then the architect basically extrapolated that distance. Okay. So the 3 foot hallway is very narrow. Now, we had those where I worked in the old law tenements. They were very common to have these very narrow hallways. Very hard for someone to get past another person, especially with an SCBA on. And so anyway, that's what we had to work with. And then I also wanted a flow and move fire attack. Now, that really lit up some people in the committee, because some of them were dead set against it. And, you know, I heard all the traditional, too much water damage, we don't need that, we don't do that, blah, blah, blah. And I said, listen, this is what the FDNY uses for the most part. And this is what I've had a lot of experience with. And I want to see this technique used. And we got it in there. So I was very happy with those two things, were very important. And if you look today at the UL water mapping problem, that is just a phenomenal learning tool.
Oh, yeah.
We'll see that it has a long hallway. I think it's a little short. It's probably 20 feet.
Right. But
basically, you get the general idea. And it's 3 feet wide and it's 8 feet tall. It's basically representative of the hallway and the last bedroom that we had in that study. So we finally get the interior attack study. So now I've always said, oh, interior attack is great, blah, blah, blah. I got a lot riding on this thing. Well, then the study comes out. And before it came out, they sent it to the committee to look at. Any editorial changes, anything you see, might be a conflict, whatever it is. You have to look over this stuff. Now, excuse me. These reports are several hundred pages long. They have one experiment here, another here. They have pieces of, you know, it's pretty well scattered. But there is a section where they kind of, you know, summarize it, so to speak. And I put in a lot of effort on that. And what I saw where I could have an opportunity to engage in this study and make some changes. And, you know, the wording is very important. Wording is very important. We had one thing where it was worded basically like, they're similar. So I'm not using the exact term. It was similar. Well, in actuality, it was like twice as much. It wasn't quite similar. It was twice as much. So, you know, that they were underemphasizing the point, and I was like, no, we have to spell this out a little bit better. And they were great. They, you know, we would go back and forth on some things for sure. Like, I felt like the timing thing was a big thing, and they put it in. It was a little different from the draft, which happens when you're doing these things. But basically what happened was we finally had science for the firefighter that went inside with a hose line. Yes. We didn't have that before.
Yes.
So transitional attack was like all over the place. We had departments saying, this is what we're going to do all the time, blah, blah, blah. This is the way to go. And then we finally came out with the second half. The defense finally got their chance to present their case. And you know what happened? We won.
Yes.
We
won.
Hands
down.
We won. We gave science to the firefighter that went inside. Now, you had a choice, but you had an informed choice.
Beautiful, man. I love it. I don't even know which question we were answering there. Oh, yeah. But, yeah, it's good. All right. Let me see another one from the audience. There's a lot of them coming at you, so I'm trying to pick a good one. Chad Small wanted to ask this because we're talking about the UL studies. He said, question, UL firefighter research related, over the years, how has your opinion of the research changed, or has it?
Yeah, my opinion of the research definitely has changed. And, of course, part of that is from being involved, but it's also their own evolution. UL's evolution. I believe like in the beginning, the UL information that came out was only really embraced by true believers and people who rushed to go see the movie the first weekend it's out. And that's about all it got. Now we're seeing there's a different tenor to the reports that are written. Keith Stakes is I've taught with Keith on a couple of occasions. He's a research engineer with them. Keith was the nozzle firefighter on all the UL interior fire attacks. And he has developed through UL and the other people that work there as well, a bridge to the fire service that I think has finally allowed everyone to cross it. And the combination of the prop, the UL prop, and these – and this, the coordinated fire attack study is really a great report. And it was kind of putting the pieces all together. Not everyone wants to read the ventilation study that came out years ago. I get that. This kind of puts it in a smaller form, puts it in the working form that a firefighter is going to go to a fire, in a house and use these ideas to their advantage, or their bosses are at least.
Right.
And I will say this, I mean, the UL, you go to a fire with UL, that fire is on. That's they don't worry about it. Like, oh, it's getting up into the attic. They're like, hey, they look for what they call a steady state of the temperature. And then they call for the fire attack. But the point is, that's a real fire. I mean, granted, we're on scene with the hose lines, and now they've moved to, they use like a host company, but they're on the direction of UL you know, then they do the fire attack. So it's the real deal. I mean, it's going like it would in anybody else's house. And so there's some very interesting things when you're actually on scene, because there are some technical issues that come up about, I'll just give you an example. We were there and they had a line on the outside of the house to do a transitional fire attack on the second floor. So they wanted to know, how long do you think it would take for this line to get repositioned to go in the front door? So we had to come up with a time span for that. And, one of the guys said 2 minutes. And I said, listen, I don't think that's going to work. 2 minutes is too long. And the terrain of this house was very interesting. It fell off. It was like you had to go downhill to get to it, and you had to come uphill to come back up. And it probably would have taken, a minute and change. But we decided on like a minute. We felt like a minute was fair. To get the line squared away and go back in. So sure. Those are the things you're on scene for. And if you're not on scene, you don't get that opportunity. Now, you can't be on scene for all of them, obviously. But so, there are some things that come up while they're actually doing it. There's some things that come up when the report is being edited. And then the delivery of the report is very important. I think the delivery method that they're using now is better. And I believe that their message is, I'll just say this. Keith and I did a class on it. We got two ovations, and I didn't see any sense in that report where people were sweating the details. In other words, it was very, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that's good stuff. There was no consternation going on there. The stuff from years ago, I think people felt like they were having stuff shoved down their throat. That's right. Not the way it is today,
right.
though.
Right. Beautiful, man. And it's a lot about who is involved and who they're inviting to be involved.
And it's a difference. You know, you get what you put in. So, you know, we had some heavy hitters on that report when we did the interior and exterior fire attack. You know, had some we probably had half a dozen people that kind of shared the same brain, came from an interior fire attack mindset, and were not afraid to talk their opinion. And then there was everybody else. But, you know, it turned out that we had, and, you know, some of the ideas that were mentioned in that first study got pushed into the second one. In the first study, a lot of the members wanted real houses. They felt that while the houses that were built were great, they just felt like if we want to really tell the fire service what's up, we need to go out in the field. And that was a change they listened to and they made for the next study.
Nice, man. I mean, that's beautiful. And that's the evolution is and listening. Awesome, man. We got importance of the senior man, why the boss needs poise, live fire training must return. Which one do you want to hit on? Because we're over an hour. I don't know your time frame. Okay.
I'm good.
Which one do you want?
I'd like to talk about the senior man a little bit.
Go.
Certainly I had my own senior men when I was a firefighter. Mike Capasco was my senior man. He probably had close to 36 years when he retired, a firefighter. You know, look, being a firefighter for that amount of time is not easy. It is not easy. You know, besides all the responses, there's the responsibility. And, you know, you are the bridge. You are downstairs in the kitchen with all the complaints. And, you know, you're going to decide what's going to be brought up to the boss and what isn't. And you're going to have the ear of the boss as you drive them around. And you're going to be a trusted advisor to the boss. And he was always there to guide the firefighters. And, you know, you did not want to have the senior man talk to you in a bad way. You know, you had respect for these firefighters. They were obviously had more time on the job than you did. They were the ones that were going to teach you how to live through this thing. And, you know, they had to have a steady hand, but they were never afraid to tell you, hey, you're out of line, or, you know, be quiet, or whatever it might be. And when we lose that, we're going to lose something in the fire service. I know that we have all these mandates and, you know, we have to be a certain way in the firehouse. I get that. But when someone can't straighten you out with a quick kick in the ass, then, you know, we're going to have a problem getting through to people.
You're right.
And the first night I worked, which I talked about in my speech a little bit, I learned – I don't know if I learned it that night, but I did learn it. I didn't really care what time I went to bed. One of the rules was you didn't go to bed before anybody else. In other words, you had to be the last person to go up to the bunk room. And we had a lot of guys that liked to stay up late. And, you know, you would stay up and, you know, they would talk to you. It wasn't like they ignored you. They would talk to you and, you know, whatever it might be. And, you know, the firehouse was where it was at. I mean, they talked about everything. They talked about fires. We had the chiefs come down and eat dinner. They talked about fires. We were always talking about fires and other people and, you know, different things. And so I never really cared too much about sleeping in the firehouse. That doesn't mean I didn't enjoy a good sleep like anybody else. But my point is, when you come to work and you don't care about that, I think you can have a much better time at work. Nice. I can remember watching guys like sweat a night where, you know, you just say, listen, guys, we're going to be running around all night here. Like, you know, you're crazy to go up. Just hang out, have another cup of coffee or whatever. Right. And they go up. And the next thing you know, they're telling them to go off and they weren't happy. And it's like, you're doing this to yourself. It's just one of these nights. You're not going to bed. Deal with it. Deal with it. So I love when firefighters are good with that. Like, you know, hang out. There's no rush. You know, we're good. What does that mean? It means come to work well rested. You know, you know, that's another thing. You know, I don't know. I mean, everybody can have their differing opinions. I just think if you can be all in for as long as you can be with whoever's around, that's great. You know, you get to know people a little bit better, the whole thing. You know, as a boss, a lot of firefighters will tell you things one-on-one that they don't necessarily want to tell you in front of other people. And you have to keep that trust. That's a trust. You can't go off and tell somebody now, hey, you know what Joe just told me? That you can't do. But it also helps you gain an understanding of where this firefighter's head is at. And, you know, you're going to find out that you got some solid people you're working with. And it's just been kind of quiet. When we did Urban Firefighter magazine, we had a couple of basically like wallflowers that kind of came out of the woodwork when we did the magazine. And one of the guys came out and he had video helmet cam footage of himself cutting roofs that nobody knew he had. He didn't talk about it. He just had a helmet cam. And then he did this series on roof cuts and we were able to incorporate it into the magazine. It was a gold mine. And he just had it. He wasn't sharing it with anybody. He just happened to have it. I mean, it was sick. It was great.
Right.
So, you know, they're there. They're quiet sometimes, but you got to find them. They're there. Sometimes, you know, the person with the loudest mouth is not the person you want. It's the quiet one in the corner that's been collecting the information and figuring it all out. I mean, filing there's a lot away, to be yeah. said for observation, to observe your people. Like, you know, as a boss, you can't always get involved in the conversation, but you can observe and you get to learn about how people are pretty good through observation.
Beautiful. Ah, the importance of senior man, dude. I love that, man. Again, if you only get to tune in for like a segment at a time, man, that's so beautiful.
The New York City Fire Department glorifies the culture of the senior firefighter. Now, you don't get paid anything. There's no extra, you know, you don't get a choice of vacation. There's nothing official about it at all. It is basically a cultural rite of passage. And I can tell you that there are some that are not good at it. And there might be somebody who's maybe not officially the senior person there, but someone is going to act that role. And you need somebody to do that, whether it's organizing, you know, get-togethers or, you know, assigning people things. If a crisis happens in the firehouse, how is that handled? You will have people step up and organize everything. And, you know, it's sad to say, but when bad things happen, good people show up. You know, you find out who really is solid and who isn't.
Right.
And a lot of firefighters are the complete package. They really are. They're just unbelievable. I just recently went to a funeral for a guy I worked with as a fireman, and he died. And he spent a lot of time at Ground Zero, basically from 2001 to 2002. Mm. He was there every day working. And so he retired. He passed away. He was like a Superman. He was one or 2 years less than me on a job, but we worked together for probably about 10 years or so. Mm. He could force any door. His name was Cody, Jim Cody. And he could force any door. He had the mindset that he would get through any door. He was a big, powerful guy. And he would come in. We built a Christmas stage for the kids' Christmas party. You know, when the kids come to the firehouse, yeah. They still use it. It's over 30 years old. They still use that same stage. We built at night, probably started at midnight, cutting it into pieces till 3 a.m. The chiefs never gave us a hard time. Never. We did all kinds of construction projects in that place. And that's where you want to learn construction, at the firehouse, not at your own house. he would work all day, come in, had a tool full, truck full of tools, and he would never say, I'm too tired. Never would say that. Always gung-ho into it, whatever. Or if he wanted to do something, guys would just gravitate towards him. They had a room upstairs that they wanted to take the wall down. Well, at 6 o'clock, they started taking the wall down. They threw it all out into the alley. And at 9 o'clock in the morning, when the garbage men showed up, they threw it all in the truck and he tipped them some money and it was done. There was no big meeting or anything. It was done.
Done.
You need firemen that are men of action.
Write that down. I'll use Kurt's line. Write that down. You need firemen who are men of action.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. I want to touch these and you tell me when you got to end it. But my bosses need poise.
Yeah. Well, poise is kind of, again, we're going to get back to the live fire training. The emphasis that we can't have live fire training that assists firefighters is kind of crazy. While we can't necessarily, you know, the burn buildings are very leaky. I'll just put it that way. So they've had problems trying to make the actual conditions that we might find at a house fire today. I get that. But you still have to engage the firefighters with their hose lines and fire. And if it means you put the whole thing out and you got to rebuild it, then you rebuild it. I mean, you know, I was out in Wisconsin one time. We were doing a live burn. But before we did that, they wanted to do something for the arson investigator. We built a plywood. We built a sheetrock house with we had like 8 or 10 guys with us. And we built 4 8-by-8 rooms out of sheetrock and 2x4s. And we put sheetrock on the ceiling and everything. And they did like 5 or 6 fire attacks in this space, and we built it all in a day or half a day. And it was nothing fantastic, but we still got the fire. Mm-hmm. We were burning real furniture, and you still had the fire of today. And whether you can get the fire of today or not, that's something you have to work on, whether you get a dedicated building and do a live burn in there, following 1403. That's great. If not, Fire Academy. But poise for the officer comes from having some experience with fire. You know, people say, oh, well, you got to put the fire out right away as soon as you see it. Listen, I've been to plenty of fires where we're waiting for the hose line to get there. And we will let that fire burn. That doesn't mean we're not going to try and cinch down the door if it's a bedroom. Yeah, because we want to do a search. So we'll close that door. Yeah, that's true. But if it's a kitchen burning and the cabinets are going and I need that light to get around because it's helping me, I'm going to let those cabinets burn. I mean, you know, this whole, you know, we hear a lot of declarative statements that real. I get it. They make good bumper stickers, but you need a little bit more refinement for that. No, I think like the officer who has poise is someone who doesn't lose their minds about what they see. I guess you could say Andy Frederick said this years ago about, you know, the garbage man doesn't get excited when he sees all those garbage cans. Yeah, you shouldn't be losing your mind either when you see the fire. When you see the fire, you should count your blessings because now you have an idea of where it is. It's when you go into a place and you don't know where that fire is and you're crawling through hot, dark smoke and you still don't know where it is. That is not a good feeling. Seeing the fire, you have a general idea where it is. It's still going to be black in there. I get that. But you have a general idea where you're going. But poise is that. Officers need to have poise about what they're seeing, controlling themselves so as not to further excite their crew. I mean, we've all seen, I know I have, I've seen bosses who love to scream at fires, you know, hey, the fire's over your head. I know that. We're trying to get down to the room. We get it. I had a fire one time. They had a transom window in the room from the old days. They were trying to let some light into the room from the hallway. So it was blowing out of there over our heads and out the front door. And so I mean, I saw it. How could I not see it? I was right underneath it. But I had to get past it and make the turn into the room. I wasn't going to just hit it from there. Because once you hit it, you lose all visibility. So the poise comes from where's the sweet spot? Where am I going to open my line? Like the big thing with flow and move that got a lot of people still uptight is, oh, but you know, you're going to open your line at the top of the hallway and go all the way down that hallway flowing water, blah, blah, blah. You can pick where you want to open up the line. You could do it at the top. You could do it midway. I don't really care. But the point is, don't be afraid to use water to protect yourself. You know, right. That's crazy. Right. We're not going to worry about a little bit of water damage when now the fire has overtaken you and now you're screaming on the radio because you're on fire. That's crazy. Don't do that to yourself.
And it all ties right back to that poise, just understanding the difference. Yeah, it's beautiful, man. I think
the live fire can give officers that poise. If you do it, you know, let's say you have an officer's class and you can put them through multiple scenarios of, you know, of just that. Like, when do you open the line? What do you tell people while you're doing the line? When I was teaching at the academy, I had an interesting thing happen. I was noticing some bosses were not verbalizing to their crew much at all. Now, it struck me as odd because anytime we would go to a vacant and do hose line operations, we would always be telling the fire, okay, move to your right, you know, hit that room on your right, hit it, you know, okay, good, move on, blah, blah, blah. And there was no verbalization. And I would take the boss on the side and I said, listen, you know, you have to tell the firefighter what you want them to do. I mean, this is all make-believe. There's no fire here. I get that. But you have to tell them what's up. And I hate to say this, but I don't think they practiced enough with their people, because to me, if they did, they would have been doing that. But, you know, I don't know what the 100% reason was, but it bothered me that they didn't do it. So, right. You know, when you're teaching, even at a fire academy, you're teaching for the bosses as well sometimes. And that's fine too. But, you know, you always want to have a little discretion in how you talk to an officer, you know. If it's going to be something a little critical, you want to take them off to the side and do it.
Beautiful. Man, there's so much good stuff to unpack. If you only listen to one scrap all of this year, this is the one. I want to talk to you about the FDNY engine book and what that was like to make and the impact it's had, and just go. I mean, just talk about it.
All right. So, it was in my target to see if it could be worked on. I had this idea because I was at the fire academy for a while. And I was like, man, you know, I knew that stuff was out of date. And they had been working on some book revisions in other areas. And so I had this idea that I would bring in officers or firefighters from all throughout the city. And we'd do like a live survey of them and say, hey man, where do you think, you know, what's wrong with this piece of this bulletin? What, you know, that idea never got off the ground. But what that idea did, after I talked to this chief, Frank Lieb, who's in charge of the fire academy now, that idea morphed into giving me the responsibility to do the book.
Nice.
And I was very happy to do it. It was probably almost a 3-year project.
Right.
So one of our initial meetings, because I had to assemble a group, and I tried to get a group that was a pretty good cross-section of the FDNY, people working in different parts of the city. We had different ranks. We had from firefighter up to battalion chief. And we had people who, because somebody asked me one time, well, why is that person on the group? Which, you know, I'm glad they asked me that in private, because that's kind of like,
right,
you know, I basically said what I believed, and I know it's true. I said, everybody brings something different to the table. We have to have what you may see as, wow, I don't know if that person belongs here. They belong here. They bring something to the table that you don't, let's say. So that's what you want. We can't all be the same, and we can't all have the same perspective. So, and we didn't. And so then the other big question, so we have this great ensemble of firefighters and bosses, and that's great. But then the idea comes back to, do we just correct it? What do we do with it? Because there's pieces all over the place here. This right. is not just all in one book. We have a thing called Evolutions that's been around forever. So we got rid of the evolutions. We didn't get rid of the evolutions. We got rid of the evolution section. And some of them live on in the main book as just things, you know, titled passages, whatever it might be. And the rest, some of them are scrapped. So there was over 200 and some odd pages that were gotten rid of, deleted, whether they were out of date or we just whittled them down and, you know, did tremendous editing on these things.
Sure.
And then we came up with like 250 pages of solid engine operations. We redid the whole book from scratch. Now, we have the original stuff. We have that. We didn't toss everything out. I don't mean it that way. But we came up with an idea that let's start from scratch on this book. And we basically have a chapter on tools. We have a chapter on the engine officer. We have a chapter on standpipe operations. We have a chapter on what we call the back step. We have, which are all the positions. We have a chapter for the drivers, the chauffeurs. Beautiful. So we have a chapter on emergencies. I used to do classes on engine company emergencies, and I felt like, you know what, we need to incorporate that in as well. So we did, and it's just a wonderful book. Now, this is a live document. In other words, in the FDNY, they come out with things, but they may have to be modified. Sure. And so this document got edited. You know, I handed it in on the last day I worked. You know, didn't physically hand it in. I sent it by computer, but sure. I handed it in on the last day I worked. And then it went for a review process for about a year, and it circulated through higher ups and other people that they wanted to get some feedback on this thing. And it wasn't fundamentally changed because it was okay. Very solid.
I wondered. I was going to ask you: did they mess with your draft much?
No. We had tweaked this pretty good over a period of time. It got some revisions, sure. Obviously. One of the things they look for is consistency of speech. In other words, if you're going to refer to something one way in right. one passage, it has to be referred to the same way throughout. So all of those things. But the readability of the product is what I think is just phenomenal. Granted, it is a section 1.1.1 says this, 1.12 says that. But the information is good. We wanted somebody to say, hey, man, we wanted to get away from, oh, that's what the book says. We wanted people to say, oh, yeah, that's what we do. And that is what the book says.
Yes.
So we were looking for that field. Dude,
that knowledge. That mind shift. Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah. We didn't want there to be a disconnect between the book and the field. So, like I said, it's a live document. What I mentioned earlier about the conversation I had about line positioning, that may be something that goes into the book in a little while later on, because we're having these discussions, which are great. And we, like I said, we have a chapter for the company officer. So even if something isn't technical, like, oh, this is how you rope stretch, you can always find a spot for it in the company officer chapter because it's consideration of operations. So,
nice.
You know, it's like, so basically that whole argument came, not argument, that whole discussion that he was having with me was basically what happens when we have to stretch a third line and how do we do it? And, you know, so
that's nice. Kind of no, it's beautiful. And Dirk Janney asked Ray, how often, you know, looking forward, how often do they review the manual?
Well, I don't think they formally review the manual, so to speak. That manual hadn't been updated in over 20 years. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean there weren't changes put in there.
Sure.
There were some changes put in there over the years. No, what happens pretty much is if there's something that they want to add, or if they say, you know, let's say something is no longer relevant for whatever reason, then they would take it out. It's pretty much done, probably more than likely, through letters to, to the chief saying, hey, listen, chief, we found this thing in here, and, you know, this isn't really relevant anymore. We had a section in there, an evolution, where the officer would call for water by raising their arm. You know, basically on the stoop of a house, and he'd signal to the driver that he wanted water in the line. He'd say, yeah, that's all right. You know, I get that. Yeah, maybe there's a lot of noise. Ambient noise is high. Yeah, that could be it. But what it really amounted to was this was a procedure they used before the radio.
Before the radio. Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
So, you know,
That's all
we
they
all have handy talkies. We don't need to do that anymore. I mean, you want to do it at a rubbish fire or something, that's fine.
Sure.
But the point is that line of sight communication, that is not in anybody's wheelhouse today. They use the radio. So
yeah,
you didn't always know where things came from, but you could somehow tell they were out of date.
Beautiful. And Dirk just posted a link to that FDNY engine company manual. So you, everybody in the audience, you can find that link right there. It is beautiful, man. And basically, it's going to be the standard until, you know, 20, 25 years from now when the next generation's Ray McCormick comes along and says, I'm going to rewrite this thing.
It was a tremendous honor for all myself and all the members of the committee to write this book because, you know, we put it in the hands of all the new firefighters, and it's from the street, and it's proven, and we have some innovative stuff in there, and we dove a little deeper on things, and it tells you pretty much how to operate in the FDNY, and it's
beautiful, man.
It's good.
No, and everybody in the audience, I want to read this comment real quick because someone said it really well. Garrett Crody, forgive me if I say your name wrong, as my normal caveat. He says, don't let the fact the title FDNY scare you away. You can apply the FDNY engine company manual to any department if you write an engine. Read it. You won't regret it. And as Ray said, it's very readable. And that's a great comment, so I wanted to put that in there.
That is. I mean, look, I know all about FDNY. Like, we're loved and we're despised at the same time. And I know, you know, I remember years ago, guys said, oh, man, I love this standpipe pack you guys have. I said, okay, cool. I said, listen, when you go back to your firehouse, the last thing you want to say is that this came from the FDNY, because then you'll just turn everybody off. But I said, you can say you created it. It's okay. But so don't get hung up on the fact that it comes from FDNY. Exactly. Look, if you're going to teach a rope stretch, you have to, you know, that's something you have to know. And, you know, that's a universal thing. That's a universal thing. There's a lot of universal stuff in there.
No, it's a valuable resource, and you can download it for free at the link that Dirk put. County Fire Tactics put it up there. I don't know where else it's out there, but you can definitely get it at that link he shared. So coming right off books, I'm going to throw it at you. I love to ask every guest that I have on the scrap, are there book or books that you think firefighters should read?
Oof. Yeah, sure. They should read their own books, first of all. You know, their own manuals, obviously. I've always said that I don't think firefighters read enough. There are a lot of good textbooks out there today. And, of course, they're going to take you in a particular path. Like I said, you got all the people that are coming down to Kurtz. Every one of them has written a decent book. I'm reading John Norman's Book of Giants right now. I just got it, and I'm reading that. That's not really a technical manual, right. But, you know, I think there's some good fire books out there. Obviously, the classics, Fire Stream Management. You know, I don't know how far back some guys want to go, but I feel like some of the classics, Fire Ground Tactics, trying to think now. Oh boy,
I put you on the spot. You said no hard questions.
You get me with the names and the book titles, but there's great information out there. I would also say read the UL report on the interior and exterior fire streams, because that's current. You know, I would love to see the fire service have a thing where guys would read older books. The problem with reading older books is, of course, that, you know, some of the information is not really current anymore. But certainly people like Emanuel Freed and you know, John O'Hagan's book on high rise, and our current authors, a lot of our current authors who have experience, write some really good books as well. I think that firefighters, you know, the world has changed. We had Urban Firefighter Magazine, which was by far the best looking fire magazine ever. And we put it out. We put out 8 issues, and then it stopped. But we had basically what I wanted in there, which was meat and potatoes, with a little bit of vegetable on the side, not much, because that's how I think Fire magazine should be. I get that a lot of people want to talk about all these other topics. I get that. But to me, a fire service publication is there to assist you in potential life-saving, whether it's yours or someone else's. And you can have, obviously, some variety, obviously. But and again, we brought in guys who wrote for us, and they'll never write again. That was the only time they'll ever write in their whole career.
Right.
That magazine connected with them. And I will say, I'll give a shout out to Fire Nuggets. Fire Nuggets was the first digital fire magazine I ever saw. And Ted Corporandi and Paul Shula put that out. And now Fire Nuggets obviously does a lot of conferences and things. But they were the first ones. I wrote for them a couple of times. You know, and they could handle the space of, you know, whatever you put out. And so could we. That was the beautiful thing. I mean, we had Steve Florian from Detroit did a PowerPoint on VPS panels for us. It was like 80 slides long. It was in the magazine because you could have videos.
Right.
You could have
everything.
PowerPoints. Gabe Angemi did like a 25-page article on vacant buildings. I mean, you can't get that in a fire service magazine today. Now, I'm not putting down fire magazines. The world has changed. Obviously, no one's waiting at their mailbox for a fire magazine sure. anymore. So that was the beauty of the digital, was that it was available 24 hours a day worldwide. You didn't need a subscription. All you needed to do was click on it, and it was yours. And, you know, some other people have tried that as well. It's not an easy thing to do. And the problem is, as much as people seem to like the idea, firefighters don't read that much, and the digital yeah. magazines tell you the truth. You'll know what pages were read and which ones weren't. It's crazy. But I still think there's opportunity for that. There are a lot of bright firefighters in the fire service who I think don't get paid enough attention to. I would, you know, we've talked about this, people that I talk to on the phone a lot, and they're tremendous. Not only are they enthusiastic, they're bright, they have great ideas, they're tremendous. And there's a bit of a disconnect there, too, with these organizations that kind of are dismissing of people who aren't in their little tribe, so to speak. And it's a shame, because to me, the changes in the fire service are coming from the grassroots. They're not coming from big organizations, not at all.
Right.
They're coming from the grassroots. We see firefighters with all different kinds of ideas and paying attention to research, or like Bill Carey. I've known Bill for a long time, and you know, he does the data, not drama, on the line of duties. And the line of duties was a thing that was pushed as a scare tactic for years about, you know, how dangerous our job was, and nobody's taking away the danger. That's there. That's real. But once you get down on the numbers, you find out some interesting facts. And
right.
While, you know, I was unfortunately, I experienced a line of duty death. One of the firefighters, Mike Davidson from my firehouse, was killed in a fire. And so, I mean, I know it firsthand what a terrible event that is. But I also know that those firefighters have to go back the next day and fight fire. Mm-hmm. You know, and we all do. It's a tough business, and it's not for everyone. And for the people that it's not for, find somewhere else to be, because it's not good to be hiding emotionally for your whole career. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a place where people who are into it belong, and people who aren't into it should find something else to do.
Could not say it better. Great. I don't even know how we got there, but that is beautiful. I have too many sound bites to grab now. All right. So not only are you the first scrap of 2022, I have to say it right, 2022.
Yeah.
I'll be saying the wrong thing for a while now. But you are also, for 100 episodes now, I have done the 5 questions for firefighters. 100 different people have answered those questions. And now it is time for the next 5 questions for firefighters. I have no idea how they're going to go over. I don't know if they'll be better or worse. But basically, you're the first person ever. So no matter what, you're going to set the high score. So Ray McCormick, are you ready for the next five questions for firefighters?
Okay, I didn't realize there was going to be a test, but I'm ready.
All right. Don't worry. The answers are 100% your opinion, and the scores are completely arbitrary and passed out by me.
Okay.
So, here we go. Number one, what single characteristic makes the difference between a run-of-the-mill firefighter and the top-tier, go-to, badass firefighter?
Well, I would, you know, I'm going to have to think about firefighters that I worked with for that, obviously, when I was a firefighter. Certainly, I think anyone who is self-indulgent and believes their own hype is not necessarily going to be the person you want to follow. Typically, the strong, silent type is usually what breeds the best firefighter. You watch their actions, not their words. I worked with a firefighter. He went on to the rescue company, and we had a lot of firefighters in our firehouse in Ladder 28 that got called to the rescue, whether 1, 4, 3, 2, all of them basically. And that's a testament to their training.
Right.
And because as I call him, Captain Morris, Bob Morris says, he's a chief in Connecticut now, but I call him Cap. And he was the captain of 28 when I was a lieutenant in 69. And he basically told me, which something I hadn't thought of, was he said, you know, I need firefighters that are good firefighters on their own, you know, because I can't supervise everybody at one time. But in the rescue world, when they are doing, you know, a technical rescue, they're pretty much together, you know, in a sense. But that independent experienced firefighter is what you want. And I would say the ones that show their performance at a fire are the ones you want to follow. What makes it, you go to all the conferences you want in the world, it'll make you a little smarter, but it doesn't mean you're going to be better than someone else. Some, and I'm using the term guys, but some guys just are naturals at this stuff. They just, you know, they can pretty much do anything and be good at it. And they just have like a sixth sense for what's happening. You know, I've seen it with, you know, nozzle firefighters, especially guys that just, They just kind of know instinctively where to go and, you know, what's happening around them. And that's not easy to get, but the great ones have it. And, you know, whether they're in the engine or the truck, guys who just have a, you know, they know their limits, you know, and are pushing the limits a lot of times. These are the people you want coming for you, one of the guys I know was they don't talk about it, but it was a wind driven fire. I know that it was up in the cock loft and he was in the adjoining apartment and he said he could feel the heat of that cock loft beating down on him like an oven. And, you know, he went as far as he could and then he had to get out of there because he knew after a while the ceiling was going to let loose and who knows what else was going to happen in there. And, you know, they're instinctive, they're intuitive. And these are the people you want to follow. So not the guy in the corner who's talking about himself so much as man, watch what they do, not what they say.
I just took so many notes off that answer. Like sitting there writing it all down. Not self-indulgent, strong, silent type. Actions, not words. Naturals, intuitive. So I'll melt it all down to intuitive. It made me remind me of Good Will Hunting when Matt Damon describes Mozart. He said he could just play.
Mm-hmm.
He could just look at the piano. He could just play.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
I love that. Okay, sorry. Excellent. Hey, you're the first person to ever answer it. You got the highest score ever on that question.
Still so, number one.
Number one. All right, the second question. And I want to give a quick history lesson. The original, I used to ask one question, which was, what's the problem with the American Fire Service? And I felt like it was a really negative question. And so I added the other four, and that was the original five questions for firefighters. There wasn't a lot of thought into it, but it became something that is just a tradition. So all of these questions have been submitted by the audience, and then I went through them, and it's really a cool thing that you guys did this. So I want to give credit where it's due. I did not make these up. These all came from the audience. So number two, coming at you, Ray. Okay. If you could go back in time and give yourself one piece of advice as a rookie, what would it be?
Wow. Well, I probably have to use the advice I give rookies now.
Beautiful.
Make your day about the fire department, not yourself. Now, that doesn't mean you don't read about something. You should read something new every day about the fire service, whether it's a, you know, whatever it is. It's a line of duty or some new tool or whatever it is. Somebody's theory that you don't even agree with, that's fine too. But I would say make your time in the firehouse about the fire department and your job. And that, don't be distracted by all this stuff on the outside. Take a break from the outside world. Immerse yourself in this world, the four walls of this world, and embrace it. You don't have to be over the top. Nobody's saying you got to be checking the rig 7 out of 8 hours. You know, that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is having an interest, having a reasonable interest, and having a process for yourself about how to conduct yourself in the firehouse every day. A buddy of mine, Matt Quinn, who worked on the book with me, and he's a big numbers guy. And he was telling me, he says, you know, isn't it interesting that, you know, we have 12 firefighters that eat dinner, and at the end of dinner, they all find something to do to clean up. No one yeah. tells them, hey, you collect the salt and pepper shakers and the ketchup, or you get the broom and you get the mop and you start on this. And you no, they all get up and they all figure out something to do. And they're not, no, and one sees, oh, that person's got the broom. All right, I'll get the mop, whatever. It all kind of just, without talking about it, it all gets done. And, you know, it's just amazing to think about that process. And, you know, we need a little bit more of that on a fire ground.
Absolutely. But, a beautiful but analogy.
But you know, intuitive, you know.
I love it. I love it, man. Yeah. I wasn't sure what I thought of these questions yet. So far, you're crushing it and making me enjoy it. So far, I'm liking it. Number three, what is your favorite training drill?
For the engine, it would be flow and move. Flow and move. I think, you know, we've talked about this. I know Dennis says, you know, it's the gold standard, and it is. It's the gold standard because when I was at the fire academy, we'd bring an engine in, we'd stretch 200 feet of hose, and we'd have them go through a fire attack, simulated fire attack. So I would have them put on all their gear. They'd be on air. And the one thing I did do, which was different, was I would pedo. We always use smoothbore. So I pedo the nozzle to make sure that everybody was at 50. Because if I'm judging XYZ engine and they're at 62 on the nozzle, and then the next day another company comes in there at 48, sure, whatever it might be, there's a fluctuation there, and it may impact how well they do on the drill. So I always wanted to dial that in, which was something we weren't really doing. And once that was straight, I was like, all right, now we can do the drill. Now
we can judge.
And now I have a standard to go by.
Sure.
So we would do that. So to me, and I don't want to sound condescending, but anyone can open the line for a few seconds and move it and then shut it down. And that may be what you want to do. But if you need to flow and move, that is the epitome of what an engineman needs to do. And so that is my favorite drill.
Beautiful. No, that's a great answer. Ah, man. Again, you've gotten max points on all three because there's no one. You were basically setting the bar for the next 100 scraps. I want you to know.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'll go back to the UL test, the UL study, when I fought to get flow and move in there. We were doing, they didn't use a circular nozzle rotation in the first study. They used that in a coordinated fire attack. I couldn't get that in, but they used the upside down U instead. And so, like I said, had to fight a lot of people for that. Worked out very well. And now all I see is people talking about making a push down a hallway. Well, you know, that was important to me. And I'm very happy that we got it into the report. I'm very happy that guys are teaching it. And you're welcome.
No, it's awesome, man. And it's your... Again, you practice what you preach. You say it's your favorite training drill. You got it in the UL NIST study. You're responsible for a lot. So thank you is what I'll say to that. Number four, what mistake have you learned the most from in your fire service career?
I would say the most you could learn from a mistake is not being fully prepared and suffering the consequences of that. Now, I wouldn't say I had bad consequences from that, but I went to a few things where I wasn't as prepared as I should have been. And, you know, you learn from that. You learn from that. And one of the things that I learned as a young firefighter was in the Midtown area was that you couldn't always see what you were getting into. The buildings were big. They were deep. They didn't give up their fires very easily. And you had to be very cautious about how you operated in a certain sense. One of the chiefs that I know brought up something that I thought was very interesting, and especially for a chief officer, is when a company's having trouble finding a fire, that's a big tip-off. They finally find it. They've been on air for a while. That's a big tip-off because now they want a piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now they start to engage with it,
but they're low.
And all of a sudden they're running out of air, and there's a potential problem for that. I had a fire when I first went up to Harlem. It was at the Apollo Theater, and it was an arson fire set in an office. And I can remember the firefighters walking around trying to find this thing. We had smoke, you know, up in the ceiling and, you know, all that stuff. And the frustration level mm-hmm. was very high. And I was like, man, it's kind of right up my alley. You know, we got to kind of look for this thing. So I went down the hall and I was touching all the doorknobs. And sure enough, I came across one that was warm. I said, I think we got a fire in here. And the guy popped the door. And sure enough, that's where it was. But it wasn't so much that I found the fire, but I was like, yeah, this is not a big deal for me. Looking for a fire, that's not. But it was a big deal for them. They were, this kind of a setup wasn't their cup of tea, so to speak. And, you have to get used to where you work. You have to. One of the things that I would say is I developed a respect for, especially for commercial buildings. Commercial buildings are a different animal than residential, and you cannot approach them like you approach a residential. You can't, you know, we had these things, and it still happens today, where store owners or store workers might be in a store overnight. There's a possibility of that. But that is not an overwhelming amount of places. It's not. And to use that as your guide for what you're going to do operationally is not necessarily correct. You know, we have to take, if it's completely locked up and sealed up like a drum, there's probably nobody in there. Could there be? Yeah, there could be. Sure, there could be. But you have to operate under a commercial mindset. You cannot be operating under a residential
mindset.
Right on. Our books always talked about the vacant as being the ladder company supports the engine in a vacant building fire operation. I would say the same is kind of true at a commercial. Once you get us in there, hang out with us. Do not be going off on your own because, you know, these big 2.5-inch lines are not responsive to change in direction that easily. And, you know, if you are off the line, and not on a guideline, you know, you have to be on a guideline. That's another thing. You just have to, bring that rope in with you because, you know, you go from hero to zero pretty quick, you know, if you don't have that rope. I've been in commercial building fires where we had so much stock. There was fire running. It was in the basement. The fire was running up in the walls. There was so much stock around the walls. You couldn't even get to the walls basically to try and open them up. And, I can remember being in this place. It was, stores, 100 by 200, whatever it was. And it just went lights out, boom, done. And, that's not a nice feeling because you don't know what's next. And the point is, you know, aggressive firefighting, I'm all about it, But you also have to temper that with, if you're the only one in here and you're breaking through this place in the middle of the night, you know, we have to be a little careful.
100%. I love it. Man, okay. Final question, number 5. And I could not find a better question to ask to get someone's mindset. So, number 5 is heavy fire and searchable space. Would you rather be assigned to the nozzle or first in on VES?
Oh, the nozzle.
I would expect nothing less. Any explanation needed? Go ahead.
Look, VES is wonderful. VES is great. You have to be careful with VES. You know, we had in our books about our brownstone fires where we had a room over. Brownstones are usually like four-story buildings. They have a big front stoop typically. That puts you on the second floor of the building. The next floor up with the bedroom above that is the third floor. And they used to refer to that as a dead man's room because the way out was through the interior or a shaft possibly in the back. Not quite the back, but the backside of that room. But that was a great place to VES because usually there was a door there, usually. If you went into the two other windows, you would open up into the main body of the apartment for the most part. So there is no like separator except right. for the apartment door now, perhaps. So if you VES, you want to go into an area that has an isolation point, if possible, because you're more than likely taking out the window. You're not opening it like a cat burglar and closing it again. More than likely, I don't think most people are doing that. So then again, then you need the separator. So with an engine, even if it's a good multi-room fire, it's basically you're just going to go through this place one room at a time, two steps at a time, and you're going to start hitting this thing. That's why. That's another reason why flow and move is so such a great technique. A lot of people miss this, but when you teach somebody to open the nozzle and to keep it open, that creates not only a cooling effect. We're doing surface cooling for the most part, surface cooling, but it also allows them the flexibility to move it to the right or to the left or wherever they need to move it if fire is seen in another spot that isn't maybe on the main hallway or whatever it might be. So it adds to our safety. I mean, there's old videos of a training thing in California where they're in this like plywood building or whatever that they built, and the fire's rolling down the hallway out of the room, and they're telling the kid to open and close the nozzle, and at some point he's got it closed when he should have it open, and it's kind of overtaking them a little bit. That doesn't happen when the line is open.
Right.
It's as simple as that. Yeah. It doesn't happen. And, you know, what are you going to say? You were stingy with the water? Who cares? We can mop up the water.
Right.
You
on.
Know, you spill some water in your house, you're not getting a brand new house because you did that. You could spill a pot of water on the floor. It'll be all right. It'll eventually dry out. you know, whatever. My point is, you know, we have to protect ourselves. So, yeah. So if I was first due or was in charge of that, the VES is great. And, you know, we've been doing that for years. We have our people and they're well trained in it. And they know they're building construction for the most part. You know, now one of the biggest traps for firefighters is going to be, you know, not only lightweight construction is a bit of a problem, but buildings aren't falling down upon us every day in lightweight construction. Floor assemblies, of course, we have to watch out for. But I think, you know, when we start making all these homes that have multiple roof spaces and, you know, varying staircases and things like very custom things. That's going to be a problem for firefighters in the future, most certainly, getting away from more of a standard approach to home construction. You know, this is another thing I used to get all the time about, oh, why do you want to use the front door? Well, you know, as I always say in my class, if a real estate agent takes you to the house, they take you through the front door. And there's a reason for that. Because you understand the house. You know, if they take you through the back slider, you're in their dining room. Where's the hallway? Where are the bedrooms? Where's the bathroom? They have no clue.
Yeah,
because the house doesn't make sense to you. Now, that's the problem for the VES firefighter, of course. They have to think about a house kind of in reverse because they're coming into a room and then they have to find the main hallway from that room. But once they do that, their orientation is pretty good. But for a hand line, You wanna claim a beachhead. You gotta own the stairs, you gotta own the hallway, and then you can fight the fire when you're going on the interior. And it's usually the front door is usually the quickest route to everything anyway. So
beautiful. Oh, man, you made me so proud of the next five questions, man. And here's the deal. I feel sorry for anybody who has to follow you now and answer those because you've set the bar. So there it is.
Well,
officially,
I'm sure you'll get a quality of answers.
I hope so. Again, man, I can say this. You have just set the bar extremely high. But there it is. The next five questions for firefighters, according to Ray McCormick. And that is officially 120 scraps in the books. 2022 is officially underway for the scrap. So, LT Ray Mack, man, my man, thank you so much for being the guest.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me. We're going to reboot in 2022, and we're going to get that culture of extinguishment going in and putting that fire out.
Absolutely. I feel like we barely scratched the surface, so I want to ask if you'll come back sometime later in the year. If
sure.
I ask, okay, I want to commit you on the air just to put you on the spot.
Let's do 6 months from now. How's that sound?
Okay, I'll write it down. Here, I'll put it in my notes. July-ish. That's what I just put. Somewhere around America's birthday.
Sounds good.
If someone wants to get a hold of you, get more information, book you for a class, how do they do that?
Well, this is kind of funny because I'm on all different media, but I'll give you my email. So it's fire. NY, like New York, men, MEN, at AOL.com. And it shouldn't be too hard to reach me. I think there's only four people using AOL today anyway. So,
who was it? Dennis was also on AOL? Was it you and Dennis or both?
No, he's far beyond AOL, I'm sure.
No, you killed it. Thank you so much. I'm going to do my housekeeping here, which is firehousevigilance.com. Go there. Buy hats, buy shirts, whatever you want. Next up, the guest next week, trying to follow Ray Mack, is Isaac Frazier, Into the Job Fireman Symposium. He'll be on in a couple days. The next thing I'm heading to is Les Lukert Fire Conference up there in Nebraska. So if you see me there, get a picture with me. I'd love to post it and do the Must Don't Scrap. If you think the scrap brings value to your firefighter life, go to firehousevigilance.com. There's buttons there. You can support the show. My whole goal is to never read an ad live on the show or sit there and get sponsors. So that's what I ask people to do. Big shout out to Chris Abaldo, Mike Kennedy, Ryan White. Thank you this week for supporting. Other than that, monster thank you for Ray McCormick for coming on and absolutely crushing the first episode of 2022. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you for inviting me and continued success with the show.
Thank you, brother. Everybody, remember, mutts don't scrap. I hope the tone stays silent. Unless it is burning, stay safe out there.
Thanks for listening to the Weekly Scrap. Please subscribe and please share. We'll see you at the next episode.